Hello and welcome to our latest edition of our ALS Association podcast. My name is Tony Heil, the Communications and Public Policy Manager here at the ALS Association Greater Philadelphia Chapter. I'm excited today because we'll be talking about ALS research. In our past podcasts, we've discussed our upcoming events like the Walk to Defeat ALS and Hot Chocolate. We've spoken to people who've been involved with the chapter for many years. And today we're going to get a different perspective on ALS as a disease. If you want to get involved and help us fight ALS, you can go to www.alsphiladelphia.org. You can also follow us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, YouTube, and Vine at ALS Philadelphia, all one word. And, of course, you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes at ALS Philadelphia. Today, if you don't know, the ALS Association Greater Philadelphia Chapter supports 850 people with ALS in eastern Pennsylvania, central and southern New Jersey, and all of Delaware. We're part of nearly 40 chapters across the country with the ALS Association, and we're excited to work with them towards one goal of eliminating ALS, and there's many ways you can do that. One way, of course, is to help support research, and that's why I'm here today with Jill Yersak, who's helped me to come with me and discuss her background and what she knows about ALS, the disease, the research that's been happening, and to put a lot of this into general English, because I don't know if you're like me, but if you read some of the papers that come out and some of the news, it can get awfully complicated, and thankfully Jill can explain things in a way that is a lot easier to understand. So Jill, welcome, and thank you for coming to our show.
Thank you for having me.
So tell me a little bit about your background in science, and then why you got involved in ALS as a disease.
Sure. So I did my bachelor's degree at Ursinus College, which is local.
In Collegeville.
In Collegeville, not far from here. And I had my bachelor's in biology there. And then afterwards, I worked as a research technician at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia in the Department of Human Genetics under Beverly Emanuel. And that experience really gave me an idea of what it's like to be a scientist. And my mentors there really pushed me and really gave me the confidence to apply to graduate school and to get my PhD. So I applied to graduate school and I ended up at Jefferson in Philadelphia, so another local place. So I stayed in Philly and I worked under Diane Mary. And in Diane's lab, she studies Kennedy's disease, which is another neurodegenerative disease that's has some similarities to ALS. So when we to journal clubs, not only we look at stuff with Kennedy's disease, we'd also look at other diseases like ALS and Huntington's and other related diseases. So we kind of got a broad overview mm-hmm. of diseases, not just the one, just the focus on one. And while I was there, I did a lot of outreach with kids, and I worked with patients and families through the Kennedy's Disease Association. And I really enjoyed that experiences. And one of my mentors, Piera Passanelli, she's a researcher at Jefferson who works in ALS.
Mm-hmm. I know her name.
Yeah, so
I don't know personally, but I know the name.
Well, she's great, and one of my mentors. And from her, I learned a lot about ALS, and I used to go to talks with her at the ALS Hope Foundation, so I learned more about ALS mm-hmm. in that way. But once I finished my PhD, I decided to do my postdoc, and my husband and I left the area, and we went to Providence, mm-hmm. Rhode Island.
And this week, I'm sure you're glad to not be in New England this week since there's more snow there than we are tall.
Yes, I talked to one of my old students, and he said he walks through a wall of snow on the way to work. It's pretty bad.
Yeah.
I was at Brown University under the direction of another mentor, Ann Hart. And with her, she actually is very well known in the C. elegans field. And the C. elegans is a worm. Mm-hmm. It's not the kind of worm you would think of, like an earthworm that's kind of gross and like wiggles around. They're actually microscopic worms. It's a well-known tool in science that are easy to maintain and very inexpensive. And I can get into that more later if you want to know about it. But essentially, we started the first ALS project in her lab. And our goal was to essentially make a new animal model or more precise animal model of ALS using C. elegans. So I had the opportunity to mentor some great students, undergraduates and graduate students, and we actually got funded by the ALS Association, which was we're very excited about. It's always great to have extra funding. And when I was there, I decided that I really wanted to get involved, again, with patients and families. So I contacted the ALS Association in Rhode Island. And the ALS Association in Rhode Island is much smaller than this association, because it's a small state.
Right. Obviously. It should be.
Yeah,
They're a great organization. There's terrific people
there. They're awesome. Yeah, so they only have one clinic, and they serve about, like, 80 patients. Mm-hmm. When I contacted them, they didn't even know research was happening at Brown. So they're excited to know things were happening locally. And I started volunteering at the clinic. And since it's a small state and there's not that many patients, I really got to know the patients and caregivers and really developed great relationships with them, which some of them I actually have kept in touch with. And then I've also, once I was involved in that, I went to support groups, and a lot of the patients were interested to know what we were doing in the lab. So I would actually take families in with me to the lab and give them tours, and show them our worms, and they could look in the microscope and learn what we did every day. It was a really fun thing that Anna and I did, and I encourage people, researchers around here, to really get involved in stuff like that too.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. There I did some advocacy and I did some fundraising. So I worked with the ALS Association in many different capacities. And so once I finished my postdoc, the first thing they said to me in Rhode Island at the ALS Association is, you have to get in touch with Jim and Ellen at the Philadelphia chapter. Yeah. So here I am.
Well, if there's one person I know that is very steeped in ALS research, it's Ellen Phillips here at our chapter. And she's known nationally and probably globally, but I don't know many people outside the country that, thankfully, at this point.
It's true.
Before we go on to the next ALS question, though, first, I used to live by your sinus right across the street.
Right.
But secondly, you said you learned what it's like to be a scientist. And I think that's something that people probably don't think about. So briefly, what is that like? Like you said, is it just that you hang out all day, and is it like an 80s movie where you're pouring things together and it makes a different color?
No, there's so many different stereotypes about scientists. This makes me laugh, especially like CSI, where they just sit in the dark all day.
Uh-huh, or they type really fast.
And they're using like really cool looking chemicals, all different fluorescent colors. It's not like that.
Yeah.
Thankfully, I had a window where I worked, and that overlooked campus. Which is good for everyone's well-being. But an everyday scientist goes to work every day and tries to figure out, lays out their experiments for the day. And experiments can take a couple hours or weeks. So you sometimes have to break things into parts. So as a scientist, you have to be very organized and have to really be able to make sure you're doing all the experiments in the right order and making sure that you're doing them as best as you can, so you don't have to keep repeating them.
Mm-hmm.
So I go to my lab, and I would meet with I'd mentor my students, like my graduate students, undergraduate students. I'd take a lot of time at the microscope to work with my worms and make sure they were well maintained. Because if you don't take care of your animals, then that could be a problem, and then you have to start all over again. So you want to make sure they're well fed and well taken care of. And things like that.
Well, yeah, I understand that completely. You need everything to work well. And I think that's going to be important information to know, that how much diligence and time goes into just organizing all your work. Because as we talk about why it takes so long to get things done and how complicated ALS is, that's something we all need to appreciate, is just how challenging science is generally.
Right. And so, you know, as a researcher, it's important to understand, like, scientists don't work normal hours. We work long hours and odd hours. So whenever our animals are ready, we go.
Right.
So we work on the weekends. We work in early mornings. We work on holidays.
Mm-hmm.
It's really a labor of love, because we really don't get paid much either, especially as a graduate student, as a postdoc. And experiments, like you see on TV, everything just works like poof, magic.
Mm-hmm.
It's like beautiful. I wish that was like that, but it's not in reality. Because once you start with a hypothesis, which is just a question, a general question, and you test it and you analyze it. And there's lots of times along the way that things could go wrong, and you have to repeat yourself. And even if things are going correctly, you have to repeat yourself at least 3 times to get an average,
mm-hmm.
to make sure things are consistent,
mm-hmm.
and you have confidence in your work. You don't want to just do it once and say, oh my gosh, great result, this is what I wanted, and move on. You have to keep at it and make sure it is what it is what it really is. Mm-hmm. Does it make sense? So, so things take time, and modeling takes time. Like, if, for me, like, I worked in C. Elegans, so a worm model, and to make a worm model, it takes a few months. Whereas, and they're eat bacteria, so it's, like, super cheap to maintain. Whereas, if you work in a mouse model, that they could, that it could take up to a year just to make the model. Mm-hmm. And they can live for years, depending on the kind of model they are. And they don't eat bacteria. They eat real food. And they are housed in these really state-of-the-art facilities that have to be maintained 24/7. So, like I said, you really have to care well for your animals. Otherwise, everything you've done doesn't matter.
Yeah, and that's something that keeps in my mind is we always ask people to fund research, and those are the kinds of things that they're funding. They're funding time, they're funding the animals, they're funding the bacteria, whatever they're using to feed them, they're funding the resources, the places. So there's a lot that goes into each individual test, much less the whole thing.
Right, and like even little things like that we use are, it's called like a pipette tip. It's just to use to transfer liquid to one vehicle to one place to another. And those tip boxes, about 100 in a box, are like $5. And we go through those like water. Mm-hmm. Just like basic things. And you have to sterilize them and they need filters. And so there's things that are little that add up really quickly. So it's expensive.
And as someone who wants a cure, you want people to use the right equipment and sterilize equipment, because if the test goes wrong because of one thing, like someone didn't wash their hands or the glove was contaminated, then you're back months or years.
Yeah, you can lose a lot of time, and that's devastating. And that's happened. It's happened to every scientist. It's horrible.
So, going back, you worked on research and got involved with ALS through your work there. What do we know? What are we sure of when it comes to ALS here in 2015? And just some of the basics that we know.
Right. So I'll just talk about first. I'll just give a little bit of background of what ALS is.
You can give whatever.
Really layman's terms, uh-huh. Then we'll go into little things that we know and don't know. So as most people know, ALS affects your neurons in your brain and your spinal cord. And neurons are a type of cell that's in your brain. And then we have about 100 billion neurons in your brain.
Give or take 20.
Yeah, give or take 20, of course. And so, and they're all, and a lot of them are, they connect to each other in all different ways. And one type of neuron that's affected in ALS are motor neurons. And their job is to make muscles move. So in ALS, there's two type of motor neurons that are affected, both upper motor neurons and lower motor neurons. Mm-hmm. So I'm a very visual learner. So if you can picture an upper motor neuron that's in your brain, mm-hmm. and that projects down to your spinal cord. So that's that connection. And then once in the spinal cord, you're at the spinal cord, your motor neuron connects your spinal cord to your muscles to help them move. Mm-hmm. So there's a signal, this pathway that goes to make a muscle move at the end, like to just to make a fist or do any mm-hmm. kind of movement you think of. So in upper motor neurons, if they're damaged in ALS, it causes symptoms like spasticity, in your muscles. So what I mean by that is that your muscles become very stiff, or if you, when you go to the doctor and they do your reflexes test and they hit your knee with the hammer, your leg will be exaggerated, that reflex. Mm-hmm. And you can see that, and I saw that in clinic.
Yeah, the first guest we had on our podcast, Matt Bellina, and you can get that podcast at iTunes. He was talking about the knee test they did, and both Larry and I, who don't have ALS, we didn't know as much about it. And that's really interesting to understand those basic things. You can kind of start moving towards understanding it more.
And a lot of those tests are some of the first signs sometimes of ALS, depending on how it progresses. Mm-hmm. And then the other type of motor neuron I talked about are lower motor neurons, which connect the spinal cord to your muscles. And if they're damaged, there's loss of that signal to your muscles. So you think of like your muscles not getting nourishment or signal anymore. So they just weaken, progressively weaken and paralyze. And so eventually they don't move. Mm-hmm. So you can't move. So in ALS patients, you see muscles like in your hands and your arms, on your limbs, and your muscles in your jaw. So all those muscles weaken, including your diaphragm. So they have problems breathing and they have problems speaking, swallowing. So that's why those muscles are dying and, mm-hmm. and they're not working properly because they're losing those signals, important signals.
So it's kind of like a game of telephone with your nerves and something gets messed up along the way.
Right, exactly.
But there's obviously much more serious consequences.
Exactly, exactly. That's a good way of saying it. So as far as what we know and we don't know, I'll start with the genetics.
Mm-hmm.
What we know is that 5 to 10% of ALS is familial, meaning that it's caused by, well, doctors and scientists have found a specific genetic mutation
mm-hmm.
in patients that could cause ALS. And right now, I don't want to give specific numbers because it changes a lot, but there's over 20 known genetic mutations that mm-hmm. cause ALS. And the most common mutations people know about are SOD1 and C9orf72.
Mm-hmm.
So the other percentage, which is a huge percentage, 90 to 95% of cases are sporadic. And that's a fancy way that doctors say that we don't know what causes it.
Mm-hmm.
It could be caused by anything. It's sporadic. And so what scientists are doing right now, they're really trying to figure out if there are other mutations out there that could be causing ALS. And I just want to mention two projects that I know are funded actually by the ALS Association through the Ice Bucket Challenge mm-hmm. money, which are really a great way of spending the money, I think. First is Project Mine.
And which we've heard a lot about, which is great.
Yeah, so that's out of UMass Worcester
mm-hmm.
and Emory. And it's a huge collaboration. It's a global collaboration with the goal to sequence the entire genome of about 15,000 ALS patients. So out of those sequences, they'll be entered into a huge international database, which will be available to ALS researchers to eventually aid in helping find different mutations and causes of ALS. And the other project is very similar. It's the New York Genome Center out of New York. And it's a large consortium with the same goals to sequence ALS patients' genomes. And they have a huge facility and a lot of great tools to actually do very in-depth analysis of these sequences, and they should be able to pull out a lot of interesting information that will be shared to ALS researchers around the world, which will be very important.
Yeah, and it's great the chapters up there in New York and Boston, Rhode Island, and all over the country really that are helping to not just fund those but then get the patients that can get there so that those researchers have the tools, meaning the people with ALS, to get the information they need.
Right, so even in Rhode Island we don't have a lot going on. We send a lot of our patients up to Harvard and to Mass General and all the scientists and doctors up there too. So we share.
Well, and even here where we have one of the biggest chapters and been around for 30 years, but we have people that go all over the country because that's where the best tests are going for what they need. And we just care about the answer, not where it's coming from.
Exactly. That's exactly right.
So
the other thing is, I'll talk about is the pathology, what we know and what we don't know. And if you can think about ALS as affecting your neuron, the neurons in your body, think of the neuron this way, as like a machine, mm-hmm. right? And so a machine has different parts that have specific jobs to help it run, right? So, for example, the neuron has a cell body, and in the cell body, it has a nucleus, and that has all your genetic information, like your DNA. They have mitochondria, which is like the neuron's powerhouse, and that helps make energy for the neuron to actually run itself. It's like the engine. And they also have proteasomes, and proteasomes are really like the trash can of the cell. So they degrade all the junk in the cell in the neuron that isn't supposed to be there. So it's just kind of a compactor and just spits things out. And also, if you think of a neuron as a cell body, like a head, it has spikes on it, like spiky hair. That's your dendrites, and that receives information from other neurons. And then on the bottom part of the neuron, this is just a very basic neuron I'm talking about, it's called an axon, and that's just a projection that goes from your cell body and it extends a long way, or it can be short, but axons can be very, very long. They can reach almost the length of your body, depending on the type. And they project to other neurons and to actually transmit signals and information to neurons, to surrounding neurons, if that makes sense. So we do not know exactly what causes ALS, but it's likely that dysfunction in more than one of these neuronal components and other components I'm keeping this very basic. There's other components, not just in neurons, that cause ALS. But it's a multifaceted problem. It's not just going to be one thing that causes it, I think.
And that's why ALS is so complicated, because you have to find out what neuron is being affected, and then how it's being affected. And the neuron is not just, I mean, you look on a description of your body and it looks like it's just a thing, but that is a very complicated thing.
Right.
And so figuring out if it's how it's getting the information, how it's using the information, or how it's giving the information, and then even more beyond that. So there's a lot to understand before you can move to the next step.
Right. So there's a lot of researchers just doing that basic research to figure out what's going wrong in the neuron. And then they figure out, okay, how can we target that dysfunction? How can we make it better? So I'm gonna give you a couple examples of what scientists are doing in that direction.
That
sounds
great.
So for example, I want to talk about the proteasome. Like I said before, the job of the proteasome and other degradation machinery in neurons is to act like a trash can to get rid of any unneeded or damaged or misfolded protein by specific degradation processes, which I'm not gonna get into. Okay, and as you can imagine, if there's a problem with this degradation system or the proteasome in the cell, misfolded proteins build up like trash and accumulate in structures. And what these structures are called, of accumulated trash, are called aggregates. So it's like an unwanted trash pile that's like stuck in your neuron that's not supposed to be there, okay? Mm-hmm. And most likely these aggregates can be toxic to the cell. And it's common in ALS patients and in ALS models that scientists have made to see aggregates that form that actually contain a mutated protein, which is made from mutated genes, known genes, ALS genes. So it's unknown exactly how aggregates are toxic, and different types of aggregate forms, they come in all different shapes and sizes, can actually be more toxic than the others. So what I mean by toxic is, you can think of like this trash pile in the middle of your cell. It's known these aggregates actually sequester and like bring in functional proteins and stockpile them. So those functional proteins that were happy and doing their thing are now stuck and they can't function. Mm-hmm. So that could be toxic to the cell. And the other, or the aggregates could actually be toxic themselves. So think of like these aggregates are just toxic because they're just clogging up the system somehow because they're not supposed to be there. So those are some examples of how they could be toxic.
So it's like if you had a trash can in your house, and you need a trash can in your house.
Yeah.
And it's important, but if it's operated properly, it goes out every day or every week. But, you know, but if it gets filled up with paper, it's not that big a deal. If it overflows with paper, it's gross. But if it starts filling up with important things like food or stuff, yeah, it starts to contaminate the house, and it becomes toxic like that.
Exactly.
And this reminds me of what we were talking about before we started. I had heard of researchers talking about this before, and it reminds me of when you're doing computer programming and you leave like a parentheses off and the program just keeps running and running and running and running, and then it messes itself up and crashes. Is that one way of kind of putting some of this?
Yeah, and that's how you could explain a genetic mutation. You have a gene that's supposed to be working properly, but it's not coded correctly.
Mm-hmm.
And you miss something like in a computer code, and things go wrong. So they stop making it, or they stop early, so it's not a fully functional protein because you missed half of it. Half of it's gone.
So that's what we know. That's what we don't know. There's a lot we don't. But what's good is that a lot of what we don't know, we know we don't know it yet.
Yeah, and a lot of like with this aggregation problem, like, researchers are out there trying to figure out what's wrong. So I want to highlight some local researchers like James Shorter. He's at Penn, and he's actually developing compounds to actually break apart those and hopefully eliminate those toxic aggregates in neurons. So that's really interesting. And the ALS Association, ND, actually just gave him funding, which is really encouraging.
Good, good. I'm glad that we're, because of the support from the Ice Bucket Challenge, but also from the Walk to Defeat ALS, Hot Chocolate, all these other events from across the area and the country and the world, really, are allowing more types of research to happen, which is good.
Right, exactly.
So, but are there things that, so now we know this, what is this mean, a promising state for ALS research right now, you think?
Oh, yeah, there's, I think it's really important to stay, to stay optimistic and be hopeful. Mm-hmm. Especially about the future of ALS, because I think it's really moving forward in some really interesting and promising directions. And I know, as a researcher, and all the ALS researchers I've ever met are super great people who really care. Mm-hmm. And they are working so hard, and they're working really long hours to do the best they can to move research forward. And it takes time and money, but I think it's totally worth all that time and money for things to be really done correctly, for whatever the outcome is, to be effective and safe. So,
unless there's something else you want to talk about with what we know about ALS or don't know, I wanted to ask about what's being done now, like the benefits of the current research and how it moves slowly or quickly, like the pace of research.
Yeah, so like I said before, things take a lot of time and a lot of effort, and things don't work like magic. You don't just go to the lab, do an experiment, and you're done. You have to keep repeating things, and you have to make sure it's correct. And I can give an example. So when I made my animal model in C. elegans, that worm model, that takes months to make, mm-hmm. just to make the model itself. Then you have to do analysis and to see the mutation I made in that worm. How is it making my worm sick? And so we do all kinds of different things to check. And you don't want to leave any stone unturned. So you check how it moves. Does it change how it moves, how it eats, even how it poops? Like, worms poop. Everyone poops. Mm-hmm. So, like, we try to check everything that's relevant that could be interesting. Mm-hmm. And we repeat these experiments at least three times. If it doesn't work, you have to start over, like I said before. And say that after a lot of hard work, I found out that this specific mutation causes ALS symptoms in my worm, and we figure out maybe why it caused the symptoms is because it affects the proteasome degradation system, like I just talked about. So that's, which would be awesome, right? So now I'm in a worm. So now I want to see, does my hypothesis and my target also work in higher organisms? Mm-hmm. So I'd call my collaborators, say Penn or Harvard or wherever, and say, here, this is what I have. Can you test this in your animal models, like your mouse models? Mm-hmm. Or they also have other things like induced pluripotent stem cells people are testing things in. And say that all takes time. If that works, then you go into clinical trials. So that's, I'm not even going to go into how long clinical trials take in the process of that, but that takes more time too. Mm-hmm. So in order to get an answer, it takes years, mm-hmm. unfortunately.
And it takes a long time just to get to the question before you can get to the answer.
Right, exactly. Because I can't tell you how many times I've asked questions and I prove myself wrong. You ask another question.
Right. There's not necessarily any dumb questions, no. But there's some questions are better than others.
Exactly. And as I've gotten to be a more senior scientist, that's part of the training process. You learn to ask better questions.
And also, that's one of the good things for anybody, whether you're an accomplished researcher or not. You ask questions, and it might be the first time that's been asked, and then someone's like, well, we never thought of that before. Let's try it. Because no approach is bad to think about, because like you said, every aspect of a model or a trial could be important, and then someone said, well, why did you ever check out how this affects it? And that's a whole other approach.
And that's why it's so important to go to for scientists to go to meetings and mm-hmm. talk to collaborators, because that's what their job is, to ask the questions that you're not asking, to think of things that you're not thinking about. And I've gotten so many great ideas from them, even like committee members, and saying, Jill, maybe you should do this instead, or ask this question. And then your project can take a huge turn in a different direction, mm-hmm. but it could be a really great direction.
That's great. So you mentioned stem cells, and that's always a hot topic. And 15 years ago, we were at one place and people were talking about it. And now it's 2015 and we're still talking about it, but I think there's still a lot that people don't know about. It sounds like, I remember a South Park episode where they're like, oh, just add some stem cells to it. And what's going on there? Is this the most exciting place, or are there other exciting things going on?
Yeah, so I think it's super exciting because 15 years ago, when stem cells were first talked about, they were made from embryos, mm-hmm. and which can be obviously very controversial. Mm-hmm. But now, through researchers like Kevin Egan up at Harvard, he was able to make stem cells, induced pluripotent stem cells are called, from actually skin biopsies from patients. So it's not as controversial, and you're actually getting instead of like having an animal model that you hope to make as precise and as close to a person as possible, it's really hard to do that. So with an induced pluripotent stem cells made from the actual AS patients, it's an actual blueprint of what's a little, let's say like a little view of what's happening mm-hmm. in the neurons in ALS patients.
So like Matt, who was on the first episode, who has ALS, he could go to one of these doctors potentially and they could make a stem cell from him. Not that he just walks in and walks out right. with some stem cells I got, but they could just do that from a regular person, which a couple decades ago was just mind-blowing.
Right, and they need people like you and I who aren't sick to also contribute. And the effort that patients, I don't think it's that, it shouldn't be, I don't know exactly what goes into it, but I know it doesn't take a long time to go in to get this done. But once we get the skin samples, it does take time to actually make the stem cells. It's a complicated process that actually takes a lot of time and money. Mm-hmm. And it's expensive because it has to have certain factors and chemicals in there to make things work and go in the right direction. But it's really cool because you can test drugs or compounds in these stem cells from ALS patients in addition to using the animal models. So it would give you more confidence that your drug or compound would work in clinical trials. So it could save money, a ton of money, in clinical trials if it doesn't pass this test.
And not only will it save money, but it'll probably make it a safer drug in the end, right? Or safer more quickly, even.
Right, exactly. It can get things much more quickly than going straight to clinical trials like we have in the past, which I don't think works.
So there's a lot of hope with that now, and there's a lot more people working on it now than there were a decade and a half ago, too.
Yeah.
Because there's a lot more places that can do it, too. I mean, I think 15 years ago, there were only a few places that were even working on stem cells.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people are collaborating more, and it's a really exciting field that it's blowing up, and mm-hmm. it's a really great thing. And the other thing I want to talk about that's really exciting is that, you know, these mouse models that have been used as the gold standard
mm-hmm.
for that are established and used to evaluate treatment regimens, they haven't really worked well, right? Because you can, as you know, there's no great treatment for ALS, no right. cure. There's riluzole, but it's not super effective.
Mm-hmm.
But these, so essentially, the mouse model using these studies focused on one gene called SOD1.
Mm-hmm.
And this gene can be associated with the development of ALS in the familial forms, like I said. And the mouse model that a lot of people have used, they actually overexpress this gene in these existing models. And what I mean by that is that they put just imagine like your mouse and its brain, and you're just throwing in a ton of mutated protein, right? Mm-hmm. Or genetic copies, right? Compared to an ALS patient, it actually only has one mutated copy and actually one normal copy. So right off the bat, it's not a lot like ALS patients. So that could be a problem. So there's a lot, and it hasn't translated into the clinical trial success. So there's a ton of people out there that are really trying to make animal models more efficient and more like ALS patients.
Yeah, and I've heard this from our researchers at Hershey Medical Center who talked a lot about what you're saying, too, which is hopeful to me that other people are seeing the same issue.
Oh, yeah, it's a huge issue. There's been papers written about it. And, you know, there's so many different ways to, like, go about doing these animal models. Like, you know, there's still mouse models that they're just trying to put only a few copies in versus like the ton of copies they did before. But also, we were doing that at Brown in low organisms like C. elegans. It's even been done in yeast. And what's great about yeast and C. elegans is they're inexpensive, and they actually have those genes that cause ALS are actually conserved. So they actually have those genes. And so once you make the model, they live very short lifespans for about like 3 weeks, and they grow up in 3 days. So you can imagine how quickly you can expedite things. And the behavioral tests are also easy to test and characterize. And
I have one question.
Yeah.
In my mind, I think a lot of people will think this too. When you look at a person with ALS, like my friend Craig.
Mm-hmm.
He's in a wheelchair, so he can't speak very well. Obviously, he can't walk, and I don't know all of his other issues. but I know what ALS means there. So if you have a worm, it's not like his speaking's a lot different, right? It's not like suddenly he can walk, couldn't walk anymore. You don't put a worm in a wheelchair. So what do you see in a worm that's different than what you would see? Like, how do you know it's working?
Right. So they have behaviors that, so a worm, it like crawls along a plate like in a, like an S-shaped form.
Uh-huh.
And worms that have ALS, they actually, a lot of them sometimes, depending how severe the model is, they don't move at all.
Mm.
They can't move. Or they move in like crazy, weird directions. Or they don't eat as well. So there's ways to decide, to understand that they're behaviorally not as they're supposed to be.
Mm-hmm.
And the benefit is of the of something in a lower organism is that you could, they're actually optically transparent, meaning that you can use fluorescence to actually light up certain neurons, and you can actually look in the microscope at high power and see those neurons and see how they're damaged.
Mm-hmm.
So that's something that's really unique. They can, that you can see not just the neurons in a dish, but actually in a living organism. So these animals, when you're looking at them, they're still, they're still alive.
So you can see that C. elegans is not moving as you would expect it to move, not acting the same way. But you can see through it, and you'd be like, oh, I can see where the telephone's broken. From the telephone.
Right, exactly. You can see this axon, there's a problem there. It's actually broken.
That's crazy.
Which is crazy, and it's really interesting. And
you couldn't do that with my friend Craig.
No, you can't do that with your friend Craig, and that's the time when we actually sit in the dark.
Uh-huh.
That's the time actually scientists, you know.
Uh-huh.
Actually take time in the dark, but most of the time it's not. But anyway, but the other cool thing is that they can do these huge screenings too, because you can look at thousands of worms at a time and throw drugs on them. And so you can do huge screens very, very quickly. So say I had these, my worms are sick, I put a thousand different types of compounds on that we were guessing that could help, and we find a hit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that's so much easier than working in with mice. Because then you can, it, you can just do things so much quicker on such a higher, like a bigger scale. Does that make sense?
That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. So, so there's a lot of things not just happening in mice, but also in lower organisms that are really trying to move forward those the animal models to make them more effective and more efficient and to get better results.
Yeah. So when you hear people who don't understand research sometimes saying, "Oh, they're spending all this money on worms." There's a good reason they're spending a lot of money on worms.
Yeah, because things are, it's cheap, and once you find something, it's easy to move up into the into other animals.
Mm-hmm. Or flies. Or
flies,
other
yeah, flies.
All sorts of things.
Yeah, anything.
So the stem cells, there's a lot of hope there. There's a lot of hope with these new models. And then you were talking about biomarkers, which I know Lucy Bruin at National and many other people are really excited about right now.
Yeah, there's so much work being done on biomarkers. And just as a background, so when you think of a biomarker, think of it like a type of signature that doctors can read, you know, in your molecules or structures in the body that indicate you have ALS, okay? So it's like some sort of, like, chemical signature.
Mm-hmm.
And the signature of these biomarkers are expected to change over time as ALS progresses. And they're super helpful and useful in that they can be used for, like, many different things. Like, so, for example, they could be used for early diagnosis of ALS. So you can help catch the disease earlier, allowing for earlier intervention, which would be great. And then also, it's also a way to track the effectiveness of a drug in clinical trials. So that's a way, it's another way of making clinical trials better,
mm-hmm.
is to have these biomarkers in addition to other outputs that we've been using. Just not just like how your friend Craig's doing in a clinical trial physically, but also saying, well, maybe the whatever signature, chemical signature is actually changing in the right direction.
So we can translate from those very small organisms and say, we know, like, even from a worm,
yeah.
that you wouldn't understand, like a person like me would be laughing saying it's not in a wheelchair, but you know that if they have ALS, it's likely to do this, and now it's doing this less or doing it not doing that,
mm-hmm.
and so that's something that may be able to approach, and we can kind of move that upward in the chain.
Yeah, and you can use C. elegans to find biomarkers,
mm-hmm.
like a change in a certain protein is upregulated or downregulated consistently when
mm-hmm.
you have ALS, and that could also be true in other when you look at other higher organisms.
Mm-hmm.
So it all kind of translates. And these biomarkers, you think of a lot of people are just it's just blood, but you can take you can look at molecules in your cerebral spinal fluid. And that the cerebral spinal fluid actually is what covers and protects your brain. In spinal cord, it's like a fluid that
mm-hmm.
surrounds it. And so people are looking at that And also there's different genetic signatures that can change. So like you can look at genes and do sequencing to figure out there's some sort of specific change that always happens when ALS progresses. And there's also a lot of cool imaging that's being done. So, you know, there's MRIs and other kind of imaging that people are working on to really tweak to make it to find specific structural changes in their brain that you can actually see on like live on MRI to see this person maybe has ALS, more likely have ALS, or you can see over time this the brain changed from day 1 to day 50 or whatever. You can see that change over time. So there's a lot of cool work that's being done. And their papers just came out from Virginia Lee and John Trojanowski's lab at Penn, who are working on biomarkers locally, and also over at Hershey, at Penn State Hershey, mm-hmm. With James Conner and his lab. So there's people locally also working on it, which is very exciting.
Yeah, you can find a video of Dr. Conner on our YouTube page at youtube.com/ALS Philadelphia. And it is really neat seeing how this is happening and that there's ways of understanding this better than there were before. And all the more reason why people should get involved in as many of these tests as possible.
Right.
And, you know, one thing that's exciting to me personally, my grandfather had ALS. And on my other side of the family, my grandmother had Parkinson's and my mom had MS. All of these tools, we can hopefully we'll get the answer to ALS, but it'll give us ways to find for other things too.
Right. My grandfather passed away from Parkinson's disease, and I totally agree. A lot of this stuff translates over mm-hmm. to other diseases. That's why when I was in graduate school working on Kennedy's disease, we still looked at ALS and at Huntington's and other and Parkinson's to see. There's this cool paper came out, and this drug or mutation, maybe that could actually help work in Kennedy's disease. That happens all the time.
And vice versa, too.
Yeah, both. Exactly.
And it's, a lot of these people you're talking about are working on many diseases, but it's not like that gene, it's not like SOD1 happens with all the diseases, but the way of looking at that. So we're not just looking for the cure. We're looking for the ways to find a cure. We're looking at how to write the book. And that book can be used in a lot of different ways.
Right.
A lot of different languages, I guess.
Exactly.
So we all have a lot of time left. I want to go into a couple of things. First, we do a lot of advocacy around the ALS Registry and the ALS Research Project mm-hmm. at the Department of Defense. Are any of those being really helpful for the research that's happening right now?
Right. Do you want me to tell you – do you want me to get into what it is? Or?
Well, the ALS Registry, we know it's getting information from people with ALS all over the country.
Right.
And, you know, what their demographics, where they're from, military history.
Yeah.
And there's all sorts of new self-screening tests. And so is that being helpful to give scientists places to look?
Right. So I was involved in this type of advocacy in Rhode Island. One of the things I did at clinic was give patients information to help them understand that this is available, not make them dope, just to know it's out there. Because a lot of patients don't even know it exists. And so all you need is a computer. Access to computer and email, and you can sign up. And as of now, we don't have any of the information yet. The CDC is still collecting information because mm-hmm. you have to have a certain number of people registered. I don't know what the magic number is, but in order to have enough information to be relevant. And so, but once it is released, it's going to be used in great ways. Like it's going to help hopefully identify places in the United States where there's a large number of ALS patients. And that could point to a possible unknown environmental cause of ALS, or it could help identify like risk factors or specific occupational hazard that could give people ALS. So it's a really promising thing, but it just takes time to get enough registrants to enroll, and then once they have that, they'll release it to all the researchers, and it'll be an open thing.
So what's exciting, though, is that the registry will help us find who and where to look at.
Yeah.
The research that's done now will find the biomarkers, so when we go to the places, the people, and say, we know where to go to the people, we know now what to look for, we know how to look, and so we'll be able to put together a much better picture in the coming years. That's
right.
Exciting.
Yeah, and it's very exciting. And they're actually also doing this bioregistry. So it's a pilot study that they're doing, but they're collecting biological samples like hair, blood from ALS patients to use to have this repository for scientists to take and use and get and do sequencing or whatever they need to do with it.
And it's 2015 now, 15 years ago. Could we have done all these things?
No.
And, you know, we don't want to wait another 15 years, but it's a much better place than where we were.
so much better. I think we have, there's so much promise. It's going to be really exciting in the next few years, I think.
Well, the most exciting thing is when we have a real answer, and you know, with the work that's being done, like you said, by researchers all over the country and by people with ALS all over the country, we're making a big difference. So how can those people get involved in supporting research? You can tell me, and then I'm going to give some other answers after that.
Okay, cool. So one of my favorite things I like to tell people is that, you know, there's so many stereotypes about scientists and what researchers do. So it's always...
It's not like NCIS.
It's not NCIS or anything weird. And we're not, like, we're actually very nice people.
Now, when I grew up, the chief scientist in my life when I was a kid was Donatello, but he was a Ninja Turtle, and I think that he probably...
He's cool, though.
He was cool, but I think there's a little bit of a difference, right?
It's very different, yeah. So, you know, I really encourage patients and caregivers or anyone else that is interested to really reach out to local researchers. And here they're all over, not in pick any big institution in Philadelphia. Most of them are doing ALS research there. And to ask them to take a tour of the lab. And then you can see firsthand what they're doing. And then they'll explain to you. They should be able to explain to you in layman's terms what's going on in the lab. And it could be interesting. And for us, like when Ann and I did this at Brown, it was super motivational for us. We really enjoyed it because, you know, it's why we go to work each day. Because there's so many days when things don't work and it's just so brutal. You think, okay, people are relying on me. And it pushes you forward. It's so super motivational. So it's nice to have patients and families come in. So you really put a face to what you're working on. And then, of course, give money. You know, that's like the big thing. Like I said, everything takes... takes time and money, so donate to the ALS Association.
And that money you're donating is going to buy time, it's going to buy the resources, it's going to buy the worms or the other animals, it's going to buy the drugs, it's going to buy the microscopes, it's going to buy the...
All the equipment, all the technology.
I mean, my fingers are full. I'm going to be counting on my toes soon.
Yeah, go on and on, yeah.
I'm not going to do that, though. So there's a lot of ways people can get involved as a person with ALS, as a family member. But you can also get involved by, like Jill said, donating. You can go to www.alsphiladelphia.org. You can get involved, as Jill's done, by going to a walk to defeat ALS. We have 7 coming up this year in 2015 through our chapter. You can go to www.gpcwalktodefeatals.org. You can come to any one of our events coming up. You can just share your story. It makes a big difference in raising awareness, which raises money. Or, like Jill has talked about, you can get involved in ALS advocacy, push for the registry funding more so we can find out where to look for answers. You can come with me and with people from all over the area. Are you hoping to get involved this year?
I'm coming.
Jill will be there. You'll get to hear from her. And we'll be in Washington, D.C. this year, May 2015, from May 10th to May 12th, talking to lawmakers. And we'll be doing that locally all year round as too. So if you want to get involved with that, email me, tony@alsphiladelphia.org. And also, if you feel free to email any more questions about research to us, and we'll send it along to Jill and others to get answers. And maybe we'll have a follow-up podcast on a lot of people's questions about research coming up in the next few weeks.
Sure.
So I'm really excited about where we're going. What are you looking forward to next in 2015 before we go?
So there's the hot chocolate event that's coming up next month. And I love chocolate, so I'm very excited. And it's at the aquarium, Venture Aquarium, Canada, which is very close.
There's penguins, there's sharks, there's all sorts.
Oh, we're members. We know. It's awesome. It's a lot of great stuff. Yeah.
And so you'll be at the hot chocolate. Jill's coming to everything, man. I better step up. I'll be at all these things too, but I'm going to be working harder. So I'll look forward to seeing you at all our events. And I hope that you'll continue to support research out there. Thanks so much, Jill, for illuminating research for us and letting us understand this a little bit more.
Thank you so much. It was really fun.
All right. Well, again, get involved at alsphiladelphia.org and look for more podcasts soon. Thank you so much.